This is House Committee only.
I just chopped liver here.
You know, yeah, you're just chopped liver with me.
No.
Okay.
How would you like this to address you? Senator chopped liver?
The Revenue Committee of the House of Representatives will come to order. We'll open a work session on bill introduction.
Paul?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you have five LCs before you. That these are the LCs that we have discussed as House Revenue Committee concepts for introduction. And there's, if you look on your we have a copy of the interim committee work plan in your packet. And this is just an updated version of what you've seen before. If you look on the back, it has a little table, and that's shows you the five LCs for the House Committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Madam Co-Chair.
And Mr. Chair, I move the following LC drafts be moved as committee bills for the 2012 session. That would be LC 166, LC 134, LC 128, LC 239, and LC 132.
Thank you.
Be introduced as committee bills.
Yeah, thank you. Representative Berger moves the following LC drafts as committee bills for the 2012 session, LC 166, LC 134, LC 128, LC 239, LC 132. Any discussion? Any objection to the motion? Motion passes. To close the work session on bill introduction. Paul, did you want to give us a quick review of the interim committee work plan, since we still have about 8 minutes before we convene with the Senate?
Okay. Mr. Chair, the committee work plan was updated based on discussions with leadership a couple weeks ago. Some of the issues you've already covered and have been discussed, and you've had some informational hearings on. The thing that was added to the list that is probably the most significant is under local finance issues. We added at the bottom there an examination of the treatment of centrally assessed property. You've had the issue come up in terms of Enterprise Zone in Central Oregon, assessing a Facebook property there that's part of Enterprise Zone agreement. You'll hear a lot more about that particular issue later in the meeting today. But it also raises a much broader issue in what is categorized as centrally assessed property, and particularly those that are called communication companies, and that will entail a much more in-depth discussion, and we would anticipate further work on that in the 13 session. So we've added that as an interim committee issue to discuss between now and next January.
Great. Any questions about this or discussion while we have a couple minutes? I think we've discussed this many times before, and let me ask, did I declare the motion passed before we closed the work session? I did. So we're finished with that piece. Is that right? All right. We'll stand in recess then until the Senate's ready to convene for our regular information meeting this morning. The House Committee on Revenue will stand in recess for just a few moments.
really quickly. So it was really kind of fun.
I'm going to have to tell my wife because we're in my
Welcome, everyone. We'll call the Joint Committee on Finance and Revenue together.
The House Committee will come off of recess and into regular session. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We have a really full agenda today, so I will ask everyone who's participating and everybody on the committee to be aware of that so that we can get out at our appointed time because people have other things on their schedule. So we will start today with an informational meeting on the senior property tax deferral.
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, today John Phillips from Department of Revenue will speak a little bit about just the current status of the program as well as some administrative changes that they're planning on making to the senior deferral program. And I have just some revenue projections from various options that could be implemented, possibly some 1 or 2 year reprieves on various parts of House Bill 2543. And so we will we'll just go over these today.
Okay, Mr. Phillips. Welcome.
Morning, Madam Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committees, John Phillips with the Oregon Department of Revenue. What I have today is just a couple of things that I thought you might be interested in. The first one is sort of what is the status of the fund, because the concern was that we would have enough money to pay the taxes for the seniors that are in the program. And so we weren't sure how many people would be disqualified. We reported to you on November 17th the status of that. I can kind of give you an update today about what happened since then, where the account is now, and what the forecast is. I thought you might be interested in that. Secondly, I thought that, and actually we worked with Legislative Revenue Office to provide the outline of a bill for you to consider that would have some housekeeping changes in it, and to the extent that you're interested in those, they're offered for your consideration. And I'll explain sort of where those come from. They're not large policy changes. They're just some small housekeeping changes that might fine-tune a little bit. So if you'd like me to proceed with that.
Please okay. Do. And that the housekeeping changes you refer to is in the bill that we will be considering later for introduction. Great. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. I would just call your attention to one of the two handouts, and it's entitled Update on the Status of the Property Tax Deferral Program. And I'm not going to read this, of course, but if you would look down at item number 9, the bottom line to this, the message on this piece of information is that at this time the department's forecast indicates there will be sufficient revenue in the deferral account to repay the state treasury the $19 million by the due date in June of 2013. So that's one of the things that I thought you'd be most interested in. You know, had the changes that you've made only eliminated a couple of hundred people, then we would not be in that situation today. This is what the handout looks like. Does everyone have?
We all have it.
We have it. I just got to find it.
I just saw some searching eyes. So.
Is it behind the desk? Might be behind.
So as you know, last May of 2011, we had a zero balance in the account. We anticipated we have about $1.2 million a month that would accrue into that account from what's called the repayments, people that leave the program, people that sell their homes. Actually, a little more than $1.2 million came in, so if we had more than that. By October, we had about $6 million. The tax bill on all of those qualified by November 15th was $9.4 million. So we ended up with... On the bottom, you'll see November 2011 in the first column of numbers. We had the $19 million, which we did get from Treasury on November 1. We had a balance. The November 14th balance was $27.7 million with that. We paid the tax bill of $9.4 million, and we had a total left over on the day after the taxes were due of $18.3 million. So it was important that we did have that money, and we knew we wouldn't need all of it, but we weren't sure how much. So that is a picture of what happened. We start the next year, the next tax year, with 18.3, and we expect, based on our projections, to have $17.2 million and have a balance At the end of next year, November 16th, and that's the year end for us, would be $24.7 million. And then the numbers proceed from there. I won't walk you through every detail, but take questions, certainly. So that just gives you a little bit of a picture of where we see the revenue is, and that's our forecast. I will tell you that there is a slight change from these numbers in that since November, we told you this in November, and we've been telling you all along that if our primary focus is to qualify every eligible applicant, and we did set some deadlines, and we said you have to have your application in by here, we have to pay by here, but we've continued to accept anybody that's qualified, and we've continued to pay for anybody that's qualified. So there have been several hundred people who have qualified either through finally submitting the right documents or getting insurance or whatever. They have qualified and we have paid those, and so there's probably slightly more than a couple $100,000 less now than there was in these numbers. And that will continue to change slightly as we proceed. We're still getting information from people. At some point that's going to have to stop, but we are looking forward to getting the 2012 applications later this month. So we're trying to close out last year and move on, but just wanted you to know that every eligible applicant, we're still making sure that their taxes are paid.
So the 2012 applicants will be new people in the program?
Madam Chair, yes.
Okay. All right. Madam Chair. Paul, what is is there an advertised deadline for application at this point?
Mr. Chair and Representative Berger, there is an April 15th deadline for the 2012-13 tax year, yes.
Okay. And if I could pursue what he said earlier, basically there was a deadline, but you kind of opened it up. If people could qualify, you kept accepting. Is that what you're saying you did?
Yes, that's what I'm saying we did, because we realized that this was a very difficult thing for people to be surprised with in a very short timeline, and you might have heard from some constituents.
We might have. Yeah, we might have.
I know we did.
I know you're shocked.
Shocked.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Okay. Senator Morris.
Thank you. John, what has your typical balance been historically before we, raided money out of the fund?
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, there really hasn't been a typical fund balance. It's really changed with sort of the fallout from participation. So when participation increases, there's a period of years down the road. It might be 7, it might be 10 years down the road where the balance increases. There were a number of withdrawals from the fund over quite a number of years, 10, 12, 15-year period. So what might have been something that we could have tracked as normal or typical was not possible to know. So I can give you, and I believe I did give you last session, I can give you again the balances that were the actual balances year to year for the last 30 years.
Including the withdrawals.
And it shows the withdrawals, yes.
I think that would be helpful, Madam Okay. Chair, to have an understanding of, what's the range of prudence?
Right.
And look at it from a historical standpoint.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Madam Chair, thank you. One of the things you just said is that that you start getting a larger balance 7 years after you've added a bunch of people to the program. I think that's what you said. We're in a situation now where we actually reduced the program as a result of the new qualification rules. And I'm guessing that the program is not likely to be as large as it was, at least for the next several years. What could you let us know, by extending these projections, what you think that effect will have as the sales numbers decline, the repayments decline, simply because the number of homes that you're paying the taxes on declines?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to do that.
I mean, based on, in order, because I'm interested in the solvency issue out several years.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to do that for your February hearings. Would that be?
Yeah.
Okay. And great. I think, of course, what we'll see is over the last couple of years when we've had significant increases in participation, like 2,000 new people in the program, there will be, you know, this spike we're projecting, and then there will be the drop-off because participation drops off. It's just a function of the participation and the amount we pay.
Well, if I could just follow up briefly, this information I think would be quite helpful for us as we deal with, I'll leave out the adjective, the Ways and Means Committee around issues having to do with fund sweeps.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes, and I might remind everyone that we have a provision in House Bill 2543 that this funds will not be swept. But
yes.
Let the record show. Okay, go ahead. Notwithstanding, I know. John, that wonderful word.
Are there any more questions on that?
Representative Arbrewer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one question for clarification. The interest that's received on repayments, is that included in our repayment number here, or where does that interest go?
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, Representative Mayor Brewer, that is included in the repayments.
Okay. If I might follow up then. Please. So we have an administrative cost, which of approximately $600,000 to $700,000 a year, an annual cost for this program, and the interest, does the interest cover that? The interest seems like, based on these numbers, that the interest may actually at least cover the administrative costs.
Actually, I don't know the amount of the interest per year. I would have to look into that. It may be that. I'm not sure, but I could look into that.
That would be just an interesting fact for me to know. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Telfer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In light of that last comment, because we're no longer using the same interest calculation, that would need to be factored in, too. Also, as you're doing projections, the parameters that you're using are the bill that we have, or the current law. If we change that, though, it may change some of those parameters in which you're basing those projections.
Senator Telfer, yes, it would.
So I guess we probably have to give some direction that if we are inclined to change anything, what we might be looking to you to incorporate into that new projection.
Yes, and we do have some preliminary projections of changes to the bill, and they all come
right
with a price tag, obviously.
Would you like me to proceed with the
Please
draft
proceed.
Bill?
Proceed. I see no more questions.
Okay. For the draft bill, we suggested four or five housekeeping items, and I'd like to just kind of talk through those. There should be a handout that is entitled Housekeeping Concepts. Some of these were developed just through our attempt to implement the bill. Some of them were developed through our conversations with seniors. And so I'll start with the first one, which was came out of a conversation I had with a senior, and then I heard the story over and over and over again. So what I'd like to describe to you is a situation where someone, under current law, someone can be delinquent on their property taxes, let's say for 2, 3, or 4 years. They can be facing foreclosure, and they can say, oh, I'd like to get into the deferral program. So they got into the deferral program, and there's what's called the delay of foreclosure, and it all of a sudden protects them from being foreclosed. It's a protection around that 2, 3, or 4 years worth of tax debt. They go into the deferral program, and eventually they die or sell their home, and then everything's paid, or what's not paid isn't paid. But now, let's say, they had a reverse mortgage, and they were invited to leave the program last November and not participate. So now, last November, they had a property tax bill to pay. Let's say it's $3,000. Now, if they pay that tax, the law would say that the payment has to go to the oldest tax year. That's the protected. Those are the protected tax years. And so they would pay that, and they would still be delinquent on the current year. And basically now the clock starts, and they will be the county will have to begin foreclosure proceedings on them within 3 years. So not only are they scrambling to find the money to pay taxes for the 11-12 tax year, They're also thinking about, what am I going to do in 3 years when I'm kicked out of my home? The concept here is to say that if someone has been inactivated from the program, their payments can go to the current tax year. Now, what that does for them is it leaves those delinquent taxes protected, protecting them from foreclosure, and allows them, if they can, not everybody will be able to, but if they can scrape together, beg or borrow the money and pay the current year's taxes, it keeps them from looking at being foreclosed on in 3 years.
And the prior taxes then would be paid off when the lien is due. In other words, all their back taxes, even though they're no longer active in the program, when they die or sell the house, the taxes still, if possible, need to be repaid. The county taxes at that time would have to be repaid as well.
Madam Chair, precisely, yes.
And which is first in line?
The county taxes.
Okay.
Yeah. So this is just a thought. This is just one way to relieve some anxiety from certain seniors who are in a... It's not everybody, but there's a subset, and it looked like a solution, and we're just offering it.
Okay. And so for the counties, there's really no change in the status quo because they were still going to have to wait for the taxes, for those protected class taxes.
Correct.
So there will be no fiscal...
That's correct.
Hit on the counties.
Madam Chair, it may actually lower their costs because they don't have to get ready for a foreclosure.
No, that's a good point.
Right, and I have talked with the tax collectors, and they're very supportive of this. They don't really want to be foreclosing on seniors' homes.
Right.
So.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Okay.
Yeah. All right.
Questions? The second issue is regarding the median real market value threshold. This was an issue, of course, for some people whose homes were valued above the median. This was a kind of a subjective determination that you had to make. What is the correct threshold for what's a large asset and what's a desperate situation? And so you created a median real market value residentially improved property threshold. And so anybody above that threshold was not allowed to be in the program. Then, in addition to that, you provided adjustments for the number of years they've been in the home. So if they've been in the home 5 to 7 years, they were at the median. Every two or three years, I think, it was adjusted up 10%. So up to 25 years, you'd been in your home 25 years or more, you could have basically a home valued at twice the county median. Okay, so that's kind of review. And we had had in our work meetings discussions about that. The county assessor said, we can do that. The thing is that not all counties keep anything that's called residentially improved median values. So it's going to look different in every county, and they're going to pull different kinds of properties into that. They might pull like a hobby farm into it. Well, it's residential, but it's not in a residence. It's not a residential area. It's on 10 acres, or maybe it's timbered, and that can skew the value. So we thought about what you were trying to achieve, and we talked with the assessors, and they all could get one similar number. And so we could get uniformity if we took what we called our Class 101 properties. And Class 101 is basically residential property, improved, not just bare land, but improved residential property, and the market value of that. And that's what we got from all the counties. We think that it would be more clear in the law if we just said that we should use that figure because it's the one number that we can get from the counties that it's going to be consistent. And if that value is too low for you, if you think that threshold is, I mean, you've talked to seniors. If you think that's wrong, we can adjust it by a percentage.
How does it compare to the other methodology? And you said if it's too low, so it tends to come in lower?
No, Madam Chair, I'm sorry. It wouldn't tend to come in lower or higher. It just is what it is. And what we would have without the 101, without some kind of a specific pinpointed data point, is we would get different assessments from each county. We would one county would say, well, I have these properties, and they would lump, and they would give us a number based on data that was different in character from another county and another county and another county. So,
Madam Chair, could I inquire?
Please.
Thank you. Do you have those numbers now, the 101 numbers?
Mr. Chair, yes, we have them. Every year they report them to us.
Well, and you have the numbers that you actually used this past year. Could you get us a table with both numbers in it?
I have it, yes. I don't have it with me today, but...
I think we're dealing with a very practical question here, and I think looking at the two sets of numbers would be helpful.
And yes, Mr. Chair, and I plan to do that for you. I just was teeing up the issue here for you today, and we've had 32 counties report that number already from last year's tax return, so we do have that number.
Okay. Madam Chair. Yeah, the table would be helpful.
Yep.
Yes, Senator Telfer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know about other counties, but one of the things I've realized in my counties with my phone calls is that there are vast differences within cities in that compared to the county. I mean, it can vary in Deschutes County 30,000-40,000 easily. You know, same house, just depends on the town. If it's in Bend, Redmond, Lapine, something like that. Vast differences for a county overall median. And so I don't want to make this more complicated, but I do know that because of the skewed numbers, mostly because of Bend, it hurts everybody else, all the other seniors' properties, because they don't qualify based on the median.
Actually, it helps, wouldn't it? Because wouldn't the median be higher in Bend?
No, but it hurts a number of them that have contacted me as I've looked at the numbers and compared them to the median. And then when you look at the county as a whole and various communities around it, major differences in the median. But I don't know if all counties recognize that or have that instance or not.
Madam Chair, Senator Telfer, yes, it's very true in almost all counties. Ashland is a good example. Seaside okay. is another good example where the people in Bend, Seaside or Ashland, you know, are being compared. You know, the rural areas or the less valuable areas are drawing down the median.
Right. Okay. That's what I would think. And so
right.
the rural
okay.
areas would actually benefit from
rural areas would benefit.
The cities would suffer.
Yeah.
But I think it's a good point. Is there any kind of a metric we could use to maybe weight or take away weight from the urban areas? In other words, to try to get a little bit more equalization, more reality into the formula.
Madam Chair, you could make any adjustments you saw fit. The more fine-tuning you do, the more complexity you add, but that's your choice.
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
All right.
Or you can apply a percentage increase of some sort.
Yeah. All right.
So that takes us to the third issue, which is recertification at the department's request. This is an issue where we talked about recertifying every participant at least every other year. So everybody that qualified this year would then have to recertify in 2 years. And we thought about that once our heads stopped spinning after session. And we thought, you know what, that's going to be a large workload every other year. And we thought maybe if you were willing to let us sort of flatten the workload rather than try to hire part-timers to come in and help us and then have slack time, and you know what I mean? So this is an idea that we could set up some kind of a review that would sort people by some objective criteria, like a Social Security number or something, that we would have them recertify at least every 3 years, and we could sort of control the flow of that to balance it.
So basically you'd have one group that certified in 2 years, and then the next group certified in 3 years, and then after that they would all certify in 2 years.
Right, Madam Chair. And there'd need to be a little flexibility, because then some people from one group might be leaving the program, others might be coming in a certain year, so that balance could get out of balance. So,
well, especially since, you're right, and especially since you have new applicants coming in all the time, and if you have a spike year.
Right. Question? We sometimes have very little control about the staff situations when we are losing people and we can't refill the position, it creates a void, you know, which over time will be made up, hopefully, but that would help us balance that.
All right, that sounds good. And then your last one?
I actually have two more. But four, just briefly, is to say that if you do make any changes to the program that would apply to the 11-12 tax year, then we have suggested some things that will need to be sort of canned language about how to treat retroactive application of that policy, whatever that is. So that's number four. And number five is certification to the assessor. The law says that these people every 2 years will certify to the assessor, and we would like to be able to work that out with the county assessor and say, look, we'll take those applications instead of you having to take them, because it also creates a burden on them if they're getting a lot of applications every 2 years. So this would just allow us to say, you know, what between the assessor, what value added can the assessor provide, send it on to us, and then we would get the certification and process it. So it would be just a way to deal with it mechanically.
And committee, this number four, the co-chairs have discussed this at some length. This really refers to discussions we've had about providing a glide path for the reverse mortgage crowd. There's about, 1,700 of them that were thrown out only on the reverse mortgage situation. It's become very... It was a larger population than we anticipated. So this number four really refers to how we would implement that kind of provision.
Madam Chair, yes.
Okay, other questions? This is very good, John. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Madam Chair,
yes, Senator Silver.
Since it's John that's here, and I know we're running out of time, I just a quick comment, and you may not have the answer. I've had a couple of constituents say that when they refinanced their house or something and they refinanced it based on the fact that they weren't going to be paying property taxes, they felt that they got some sort of communication from the state, as well as in ensuing years. It kind of was a contractual relationship, and that if you follow these guidelines, you'll never pay property taxes. And those guidelines were at the time. Or they were able to get the financing based on something from the state that said they won't be paying property taxes, therefore they'll be saving their $200 a month, and therefore they qualified for some sort of a mortgage. My concern here is more, do we have a contractual relationship that the latest legislation has impeded? Is there a sense that we have a contractual relationship to some of these, if not all, people in the program?
Madam Chair, Senator Telfer, I don't know particularly what document they were looking at. I would tend to think that it would not be a future commitment. We might have said what the law provided, but your own legislative counsel has opined that the program was not a contractual relationship. It was not an entitlement. And based on that, I think you made the changes last session.
Okay, I appreciate that. I've asked for some of those constituents to see if they can find that letter they got when they financed, were approved the financing, and I have yet to see one of those letters. So,
And
I think I've seen that the legislative council opinion. Maybe if you could get that again to the committee. Is there a written opinion on this? Because it sounds familiar when you say that, or maybe it was just a testimony in front of the committee.
I don't recall. Christine, do you?
Well, Madam Chair, we did have testimony that some people who were offering reverse mortgages explained that you could have the reverse mortgage and the property tax deferral under the old law. One assumes that none of those people are saying that now.
Right. Okay.
Madam Chair, if I could add.
Yes.
The bill itself has another provision not mentioned in our housekeeping issues, and it's in Section 1 of the LC, I should say, LC 166. And it's that before entering into agreement for reverse mortgage, that the person be notified that they would not qualify, or they would be notified of this program change. So that was worked out with Paul and Christine and I with DCBS, we talked about brainstorming some ways to avoid this problem in the future. And DCBS came up with this suggestion that in the notice, when they're signing up for reverse mortgage, that they at least be notified.
Right. And if they're already in the program, they don't, the reverse mortgage people would make them pay back their back taxes, correct?
I assume so, yes.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Any other questions? Anything else? Very good.
Thank you.
Got through this great dispatch. Okay.
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the there's some simple like revenue projections that I've done on various changes that might happen to the program, just for your consideration. Obviously, the range of changes that could be made is nearly infinite. So, I was just going through some of the consequences of the major ones. The program repayments in, payments net, and balance has been outlined for just the current statute and the after House Bill 2543 and the changes have been implemented. It should be noted that these numbers don't include the $19 million loan that went into the program, so it would show a negative balance in years that the program wouldn't be able to pay the loan back. But as you can see, also the program is on track to be able to pay the loan back by the deadline of 2013. And the so under the current statute, the program has a net of $6.6 million in this year and only a negative balance of $700,000. And then the next year, the net of $6.4 million will bring it up to $5.7 and put the program back into the black by 2012, absent the $19 million, of course.
Now, wait a minute. What do you mean by absent the $19
million? It's just not in here.
It's just exclusive. It's subtracted. So you, if you actually
So we're not using any of it. We're not paying back any of it.
Yes.
It's just off to the side.
It's off to the side, okay, for this analysis. So.
Well, but we are using 700,000 of it.
Yeah, we are, but it's that's shown here. Yes.
Madam Chair, if I could ask Christine, that by current status, you mean including current number of participants?
Correct. And with the elimination of the people who were excluded due to House Bill 2543.
Thank you.
Okay. And so the option would be to apply the reverse mortgage changes with perhaps a one-year delay, and that would include those 1,543 participants who have been excluded solely due to reverse mortgages and add them back into the program. Also, because the average person is in the program for 7 years, one-seventh of the people are phased in and out each year, and their ability to repay according to the analysis I've done previously on reverse mortgages is also taken into account here. So their repayments are reduced repayments are factored in here due to people having reverse mortgages out. And as you can see, it makes that revenue hole, once again, the $19 million to the side, it just makes the program balance negative $3.8 million in 2011. And then a net of $6.6 million in 2012 would bring it back up.
So basically, we would not be jeopardized in repaying the loan.
That's correct.
Okay.
If a two-year delay were considered, so that means that those participants who had been excluded for reverse mortgages would be continued have a continuation in the program for 2 years as opposed to just the 1 year, you can see that the program would have a positive balance in 2012, but only $100,000, and it's you know, potentially the fact that this is a forecast might mean that the program is still below that below zero at that time. Mm-hmm. That's a slim margin, if you will. And I guess another option would be to wait 1 year to apply any of the changes on House Bill 2543. So that would result in the program not crossing back into a positive balance until 2013. And still be able to meet the program in this case would not be able to meet the deadline to transfer the $19 million, but in the future, the net to the program would eventually make them able to pay that amount. I think it would trigger the requirements in Senate Bill 939 that the program transfer what they have, as well as trigger the reporting requirements about how the program may be changed into the future. And just a kind of a historical refresher, this next slide would show what happened prior to the House Bill 2543 law, that, you know, the program was on a more of a downward course, and it was expected to have a $12.7 million negative balance in 2011 and just dropping from there. And so this is a reminder that House Bill 2543 was necessary.
Representative Brewer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This only goes out to 2015, and we're in, you know, the starting baseline is 2011. And it looks like, well, first off, the top line outside the first chart is using revenue rather than repayments, and that's not really revenue. It's just reimbursement for what the state's already paid out on behalf. But it looks like on a cash flow basis, our cash in and then our payments out for current tax payments, so our cash in on our receivables and then our current payments on creating new receivables ends up annually at a net positive. However, the only reason why that's happening, if I understand you correctly, is the repayments to us in this time frame up through 2015 are based on a higher level of participants in prior years. So that very high rate of repayment is going to drop off on that average of 7 years in the program. And that high level of repayment is going to drop off. And what I anticipate is that some point under the revised law, the repayments and new payments out are going to net to approximately zero or even possibly in the negative or positive. I'm not sure. And it would be helpful to find out, because this paints too rosy of a picture. It's just kicking this problem potentially down the road where we're going to revisit the same problem again, particularly in light of our current new payments are on flattening or depreciating market values. So have you done projections beyond 15 so we can look at cash flow at that point? How far out have you gone, and what do those numbers look like?
Madam Chair, Representative Air Brewer, this is based on two things. First of all, it comes from the projections of the program balances and repayments and payments out that come from Department of Revenue at the base. And then from that, I've projected changes based on adding people or taking people away from the program. I will work with Department of Revenue to get projections out past this 2015 place.
Yeah,
and to also
and that's an excellent point, because by lowering the maximum value of the homes, mm-hmm. we actually, you know, looking forward, that's going to have an impact on the repayment. Do you think that is something that you can, do you think it's gettable based on what we know?
Yes. Madam Chair, I think that the reduction in repayments is obviously something that is factored into this revenue projection and projection for the program.
Because it will become more mm-hmm. pronounced in the future.
Madam Chair, I asked essentially this question mm-hmm. of Mr. Phillips when he was at the table, and he indicated, if I recall, that he would get those numbers for us.
Okay. I see nodding. Okay. All right, Christine.
And finally, this, the final page would be a summary of all of the different options that were presented. You can see the declining program balance that would come if House Bill 2043 were not implemented, and then just the various options and when, at what point that program would cross above a zero balance for the various. So it's just a summary slide to see that.
So the 1 year delay would be the line right below baseline.
Correct.
All right. Okay. Well, this is very helpful. Other questions? Thank you. We are right on schedule. Do you have any more, Christine? Okay. We are right on schedule. Thank you very much. And we will now move to our next item, which I will find. Briefing from the Oregon Education Investment Board. Mr. Tim Nesbitt, are you here? He's not here.
Ben Cannon is here.
Ben, are you doing it? Okay. Okay. We'll go out of order then. Do we have Department of Energy here? Yes. If they're all ready, we'll go out of order and do the review of the renewable energy project tax credit auction. What? He's coming? Okay.
All right, Lisa, you're up.
We will, so that we don't violate our notice requirements, we'll go back to the Education Investment Board. Well, it was requested by. Welcome to the committee.
Morning. Madam Chair, Representative Co-Chairs, and members of the committee, I'm Tim Nesbitt. We're out of breath since I was running from another meeting, excuse me. And I'm the manager of the Governor's Oregon Education Investment Project. I'm passing out to you the executive summary of the Oregon Education Investment Board report, which was delivered to you mid-December, as required by Senate Bill 909, and a copy of a summary of the request to the Federal Department of Education for a waiver from the so-called No Child Left Behind Act and its provisions. That's been posted and is on schedule to be submitted Monday of next week. What's common to both the waiver request and to one of the pieces of legislation from the Investment Board is the use of achievement compacts to establish partnership agreements with all of our K-12 school districts, our education service districts, our community colleges, and our university system, which would set high-level outcomes and goals in areas of completion, for example, high school diplomas, and in the post-secondary institutions, certificates and degrees, validation of knowledge and skills, connections to the economy and society, so very high-level measures. And a short list. So all these compacts we'll show to the Senate Education Committee tomorrow what they look like. In fact, some of our districts are preparing samples which capture the highest, again, the most significant outcomes that we think all districts should be striving to achieve. Focused on another piece of legislation you passed last session, Senate Bill 253, related to the 40-40-20 goals for high school and college completion. The achievement compacts reflect a model already in effect in many of our most successful and improving school districts, which is that they set goals. They do that school by school. They look at comparisons of results school by school, especially where we can identify schools with similar student populations, similar in terms of racial and other socioeconomic indicators, and where schools with similar student populations have very different outcomes, spending roughly the same dollars per student. It's been very instructive to the superintendents, and you'll hear more on this in later testimony in the session, It's been very instructive to them to then identify what they can learn from the better performing schools and bring the lesser performing schools up to par. That's the model for the achievement compact. I think the question you wanted me to ask is how might this affect the school funding formula? And the answer is that achievement compacts can work with any level of funding, however structured. You determine what the funding formula looks like and the level of funding. The achievement compact allows a district in partnership with a state to tell us what they can achieve with that level of funding. We think as they take effect and you see results, you all see results over time, and again, be able to better compare similar districts to similar districts. We will have a better idea of what's working, a better idea of whether the funding levels or the structure of the funding formula is accomplishing your purposes. So I wouldn't say that achievement compacts would never be tied to a discussion in the future about is this the way to structure the funding or the level of funding. But it, as I said, it's not intended to do that. Its primary purpose is to set goals and learn from the achievement of goals district by district and to be consistent with what's reflected in the No Child Left Behind waiver, which is the philosophy of tight loose, that we're tight on outcomes at the state level. We're focused on investment, direction, coordination, and support for our districts. But we're loose in the sense that we're giving maximum flexibility to districts and educators to achieve our high-level outcomes.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This was an item that I asked to be put on the agenda this morning because when you presented to the Oregon Leadership Conference in Portland last month, it appeared to me, based on the presentation that you were making then, that the compacts and the differential results on the compacts from different districts might result in a need to address the formula, either in the manner that you're suggesting now or because of the need to influence districts into making the kinds of administrative or pedagogical changes that would be necessary in order to meet the criteria. I think I recognize the tight loose idea, and I like it a lot, I will tell you. The idea that the state has a set of standards that it wants applied, outcomes that it would like to see happen, and then expects the districts to figure out how to do that. That makes a lot of sense to me. What happens, though, and it may be that you can't answer the question today, but I think... The question I have, and it led to my asking to have this meeting this morning, is what happens if you put out a request for a certain outcome and you don't get it? The results are not, at least in some districts, do not come up to a measure that would compare to districts that are doing it in a way that actually works. What do you do then? And does that have any influence at all, or would you think it's likely to have an influence on proposals having to do with the way in which or the amount to which a district is funded? And if it would, then, of course, that becomes a formula question.
Co-Chair Barnhart, discussion at the board has been focused on two things. One, in the case of results in achievement compacts showing comparative underachievement and highlighting the need for to do better, we will enter a phase of diagnosis, and this is a system yet to be developed once we get our chief education officer on board. But the governor has talked about first step is diagnosis. What's not working? What could we learn from districts with similar student populations that is working better? Are you putting enough resources into third grade reading? Are you putting enough attention to eighth grade math or a segment, a learning stage that may be what some educators are calling momentum or leverage points, which one district may be failing to do that? And I've had many conversations with school board members around the state, and they sometimes share with me the thought that maybe we do need more direction on where to put the dollars. But very often that's not the case. They're the experts, they're administrators and teachers, they're the educators, and they can learn from what's working in another district. There is a whole list of other interventions which were part of the existing No Child Left Behind Act and are still part of what we would be able to call our toolbox for intervening that you see listed in this summary. And Ben Cannon, who's here, can walk you through if you need more information. He's a lot more familiar with the waiver and those next steps. Secondly, there's been discussion at the board of how a governor's budget request or governor's recommended budget for 13-15 might be designed to, say, focus first on the baseline of funding that you now know as the funding that flows through the formula. But in addition, looking at increments above that baseline, which could be focused towards a innovative practice in certain districts. There's also the innovation of a P20 database, which is going to require some investment. That's statewide. And also, once better practices are identified, ways in which dollars could flow to reward districts which are adopters of these better practices and getting better results. So, but again, this is still a discussion that the board is undertaking. It's going to be something that we bring to another level of understanding during this year, and we'll be sharing with you as we proceed.
Representative Gilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for coming in for all the time we've spent talking. Every time we talk, I have more questions, and as we get closer to February, the questions start to feel more pressing because I know that we'll need to vote on where we're going on these issues. I think following up on Representative Barnhart's question, I'm still confused about what these compacts are. If they are intended just to spur conversation, then they are an aspirational document, and I wonder how they deviate from the district improvement plans right now that school districts do each year to look at where things are underachieving, which populations are underachieving, and what they are going to do to address those issues, and then they report that to the department. There's some monitoring. If it's something more than that and not aspirational, I'm wondering if you could be more specific. If Philomath, for instance, comes forward with a compact and they don't fulfill any of the promises on that compact, is the consequence the next year, if school funding is based on these compacts, do we just not send school funding to Philomath anymore? Or alternately, when you talked about the board influencing those boards, is it kind of a state takeover of that board where someone comes in and directs the policies and spending of that district? I guess I'm not seeing what the teeth of the compact is.
Yeah, if you could focus on the impact on the funding, that would be great.
Yes, Madam Chair and Representative Gelser, yes, a lot of connections to school improvement plans from what's going on now, and actually that's the implementation phase, which will be informed once a school board sets its goals. It's very much a school improvement-like process that will be followed. In terms of the funding, we're not saying that if a district, first of all, a district is setting targets for goals which will be shared statewide, so all districts will be looking at those same targets. And again, we want alignment with our 40-40-20 high school and college completion goals. That's kind of that's quite prominent in the compact. We think that once a district sets its targets, and some of them may choose to set a range, then we will learn a lot again from the results. We're not saying that in order to receive state funding, you have to enter into a compact. We're saying it's a requirement that you enter into a compact. But then the results of that compact, as I described, would trigger more of a look, more of a diagnosis, and more interventions of the kind I was describing. The trouble with a consequence of pulling funding is you penalize the student. So you have to look for ways to intervene that help student success, help the school board or help the administration, or drive change where needed in that dialogue between the state as partner, focused on the outcomes, and the district as the entity who's a partner in the compact, focused on those same outcomes and the targets and delivering them. We can't think of any system where the dollars would be pulled. As a matter of fact, in some instances, we may need some resources allocated to help a district get up to get up to par. But it will be informative if we're finding that there's some pattern in district budgeting where costs are not under control, and a lot of the discussions will be over time. We've heard this discussion at our board. What about the small districts which can't make it anymore? What about the incentives for consolidation? So all those will be part of an ongoing discussion once we are informed by the results of an achievement compact.
Just a follow-up?
Quickly.
Please, thank you. So what I'm hearing is that the compacts really are kind of a new generation of these district improvement plans. Districts are not at risk of financial change, and this is really more of a planning study process rather than an action process. It's not a direct change of how instruction is provided in districts. It's a tool to better understand how things are provided rather than a change or reform.
And Madam Chair and Representative, we think more than that, because we think it's quite informative to be as part of your budgeting to be adopting targets for these goals, and for all districts to be adopting targets for the same goals statewide. It will bring, right now, most of what, if not all of what's going to be in the achievement compacts, the data you can find the data for all of those goals on the Oregon report card. But the data comes in 12, 14, 18 months later. It will be a qualitative change to have all districts, when they adopt their budget, looking forward and setting their goals looking forward, and then being focused during the school year through their school improvement plan processes and others they may put in place to achieve those goals. It will make the data more than, again, something which comes in after the school year and tells you how you did, and more a target to achieve. And districts will want to be getting regular reports on how they're doing. And where we see this happening in school districts now, at the school level, it appears to work. So it's more than just an aspirational effort. It's a strategic planning effort. It's connected to the budget. It's connected to school improvement plans. It's focused that all districts, we would hope, are on the same page, gaining from the setting of targets and learning from each other, district to district, as they work to achieve them.
Thank you. Representative Bentz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, part of the question I had was answered, but in having spent a bunch of time on school boards, it seems to me that the identification of the problem, the opportunity to identify the problems, has been around with us a very long time, and I can't help but think that I haven't yet heard anything that's going to change the outcomes we all hope to change. That is, identifying a shortfall in Burns or Klamath Falls or Medford that somehow doesn't exist in Lake Oswego, and then quickly taking whatever's working in Lake Oswego to Klamath Falls. I don't want to pick on Klamath Falls. Let's reverse it. Take it to Lake Oswego and get those underachievers doing something. I'm not sure I'm hopeful as so much as cynical about the effort. And I have not yet heard what actually is going to work. And I want it to work, but I haven't heard it. And I think that's what maybe a lot of us are waiting for. Okay, so maybe you could go to the absolute point of what it is that's going to be working better for our schools as a result of all this incredible motion. I almost want to say on the deck, but why don't you just say what's going to happen?
And if you could be very brief, because this is going to be a much larger discussion in our education committees.
Madam Co-Chair and Representative Bentz, and there'll be a lot more discussion tomorrow. I'm here by myself, focused on the one question to answer. We have superintendents joining me tomorrow. We'll be at the Senate Education Committee, and they're going to be able to kind of walk through exactly how they're doing it, in some cases doing dry runs in their districts now and modeling the achievement compact on what's working in their districts. I would say that for the comparative improvement process to work, we have to be comparing districts with similar student populations. So a comparison of Lake Oswego to Klamath Falls might not be instructive at all, but one that compares districts with similar student populations might be very instructive. Further, that process of, to go back to your point about so many ideas having come forward before and what's different about this one, we hear a lot from educators of reform churn. That's the critical term used, where there's been different ideas rolled out every year or two, and they're tired of them. They adjust to them, try to. They don't always work, and then something else comes up. This is intended to step back and create a framework that can work for all, but allow maximum flexibility at the local level and not be trying to dictate exactly what's happening in the classroom or a new reform idea from year to year. The idea is we'll focus on outcomes, and I think all districts focused on the same outcomes, and reporting results and us being able to compare, again, among similar student across similar student populations will be most instructive.
And if you, and I don't mean to cut you off, and this is my concern with this agenda item, because we are not the Education Committee, we're the Revenue Committee, so I am going to cut it off at this point. But give you a chance if you have any other points to make about the potential impact on the school funding formula.
Well, as I said, the achievement compacts can work with any level of funding, however structured. And so, however you do your budget rebalance in February, and we're hopeful it's not dire. The achievement compacts can then be a tool for districts to tell us what they can do with state and local funding combined to achieve these common goals we've set.
Thank you very much. Okay, thank you. Sorry to rush through this. I want to stay on schedule as much as we can. Okay, our next item, a review of the Renewable Energy Project Tax Credit Auction.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Last session, and as part of House Bill 3672, two of the credits that were in that bill, the selling of those credits was converted to an auction process. You had the film and video credit, and they'll go through an auction next year. The first credit that was sold by an auction is the renewable energy credit, the new version of that moving forward. And you have the Department of Revenue and Department of Energy here to talk about how that auction went.
Okay. Welcome, committee.
Good morning, Chair Burdick and Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. I'm Ken Ross from the Department of Revenue. Just a quick overview, as Chris said, of the tax credit auction that we held at the end of last year, 2011. As the bill directed, we got together with Energy to develop an auction process, and I'll admit we were a little auction challenged because we'd never done anything like this before. We brought in film and video or film and television because they have some history of selling tax credits. So we met, we developed a process, we landed on an online bidding process. It was a closed bidding, so it wasn't like eBay where you bid and you can see the next person up to you. You didn't know what others were bidding until we posted the results. We set up a web page, a page on our website for folks to submit their bids, and you could bid as many times as you wanted to, submit as many as you thought you needed to, and it wasn't valid until we received a bankable payment from you. And we set a payment due date, I think it was about 10 days after the auction ended. We decided to sell the credits. We had we could sell up to $1.5 million as directed in the bill. We set them at $1,000 increments, and the bill specified that we couldn't sell them any less than 95% of face value. So for $950, you could get a $1,000 tax credit. To get the word out, we posted an announcement. We put it on our websites, both Revenue and Energy. We did news releases. We also enlisted our listservs, where we sent out notices to those folks that are subscribed. And for Revenue, that's the tax practitioner community, the CPAs and the LTCs of the world. We also dedicated a toll-free line, a number for Revenue, and we had a dedicated email address so people could get to us quickly. We did two auctions, and we did one two-week auction in late October and then another one in December, and the results of the auctions are the third page of the handout. I believe you do have this handout, right? Okay. The first auction, we had 24 bidders, and one of those was a corporation. Most of them were individuals. They bought 406 increments, so tax credits worth $406,000, and they paid about $412,000 to do that.
What percentage is that?
I don't know the percentage, Chair Burdick, but it's a $6,000. It was more than face value of the credits. But we sold less than a third of the available credits, so we met with Energy and said, let's go out with another one. So we did a second one for about 10 days in early December, and we got another 10 bidders, sold another 55 increments or $55,000 worth of credits. This time they sold for less than face value. Your sheet doesn't have the grand total on there, I don't believe. It's in the summary. But we sold $461,000 worth of credits for about $464,000. So we sold $3,000 more than what potentially could show up on the tax returns.
So what would motivate somebody to pay more than face value?
Chair Burdick, we don't actually know, and we haven't done a survey of those who bought, so we don't know if it was the goodness of their heart, they just really believed in the renewable energy program, or if it was good tax planning, we're not sure.
Representative Bailey, I think this is a certified success.
And the only thing, the other last little piece I wanted to add on that, the $464,000 that actually got sent to the Renewable Energy Fund was net of admin expenses. We were allowed to keep a 0.25% for admin expenses, which amounted to about $1,100. So I'll take questions.
This is very good news. Representative Brewer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am startled as a tax planner. I'm not sure that I would ever tell my client to pay more. I mean, quite honestly, the case history and IRS is quite clear that anything above the tax credit would be a charitable contribution, and we are a charitable organization as the state of Oregon. So we're looking for donations.
We'll take the money.
We're
501c3, but not charitable.
So I'm not sure about that, but I do have an opinion. This is probably more for the committee. Thinking back on this and in light of other tax law unfavorable to the taxpayer, we allow a minimum return directly on the credit of 5%. Now, that sounds good except for federal purposes, that 5% has to be taken back into income as capital gain. It's a return on their investment. And yet they can, for federal purposes, get an offsetting state tax deduction because they now have basis in it. So for federal purposes, they kind of net out to zero. But we screw those potential folks funding this program in the state of Oregon because in Oregon, and you're smiling because you know where I'm going, they have to include that 5% back into income but have no offsetting state deduction. So they have to, in essence, pay state tax on that 5%. Or if they're bidding, it's even less than that. And so then you look at the time value of money. The auction was the first one was in August or so?
Late October.
Late October. So depending on where they are in their tax year and when they have to make tax payments, they may have better use of the time value of money rather than that eroding return on their investment. And so I think the 5% incentive, because of our state tax structure in taxing that discount, is a disincentive. It may be too small a return on their investment for someone willing to do it. So we might want to look at that and provide a carve-out specifically for that they don't have to, for Oregon purposes, take that discount back into income.
That's an interesting thought, yeah. Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. Just very quickly to follow up on this, and maybe to maybe you that may be a question you want to answer. As I understand that, many of the people who are likely to bid on these kinds of things are people who make quarterly estimate payments and towed up at the end of when they actually file their return and face penalties if they don't pay the correct amount in each quarter. As I understand it, this kind of a certificate comes right off the top of the taxes due and therefore reduce the amount that needs to be paid in the quarters that are coming up. So the result might be that a purchase in October means that the January payment can be short. And so the time value of money issue really only extends from the date you that the department cashes your check until January 15th, when the next quarterly payment's due anyway. So we're, even though the annual, even the, an annualized rate looks a lot higher than 5%, when you're considering it's only a month and a half or 2 months between the two.
Potentially.
Yeah.
You're done.
Yeah. Thank
Representative
you.
Bailey.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. In addition to the technical concerns around tax law, while I would love it to be the case, it seems unlikely that we can continue to rely on folks to pay a dime for a nickel. I think it is worth exploring or continuing to explore for the department the option of an appropriation in lieu of a tax credit in order to perhaps have a more efficient mechanism. Has the department looked into that option at all?
Madam Chair, Representative Bailey, Lisa Panero from the Oregon Department of Energy, for the record. We have had some very, very preliminary conversations about it, and we know that there is some interest in looking at that as an alternative option. So we are open to having those further conversations with you.
Thank you.
Senator Hess.
Thank you. At least, though, it shows that it's better than what it was with 20-30% discounts. Yep. So we can figure this out easy enough without having to go back to how we previously did this.
Excellent point. Representative Benz.
Thank you. I think the Senator took my point. But is that indeed the measure of the efficiency that's been achieved by virtue of this? Somewhere between 5% and 20-30%? How much better off are we as a result of this process as compared to what we used to do? What's the measure of the efficiency gain?
Madam Chair, Representative Benz, I am not certain that I, A, understand the question clear enough to be able to respond to you, and so I would have to have a little bit more context.
If I may.
Please follow
okay,
up.
Okay, so this means of creating money using a tax credit costs the state 5%. In the past, the assertion made by the Senator, which I agree with, is it costs us more than that. The idea of having this was to make a more efficient means of generating money through the use of a tax credit. How much has this new approach saved the state?
Madam Chair, Representative Benz, you know, I would going to have to rely on some other folks within the agency to do those types of calculations and estimations. So if you wouldn't mind, I would love to be able to get back to you on that question.
Well, I can jump in a little bit. Representative Benz, it's really not the state that saves the money. We're on the hook for the tax credit.
Yeah.
It's the recipient who gets the use of the discount of the actual money.
Thank you for clarifying my question, Madam Chair. I want to know how much more of the state's investment we're actually putting into the project. That's a better way of putting it.
Correct.
And so the point, though, is how much better off are we by using this method as the one we previously utilized? What's that space?
Right.
So if I could get that, that would be great.
Yeah, if you could get back, that's an excellent question. Other questions? Are you done with your part of it, or do you want to continue?
Madam Chair, I'm done. Thank you.
Okay. And Lisa, do you have more to add?
Madam Chair, I do not have any more to add at this point.
Great.
All right. Any more questions from the committee? Thank you. And wait a second. I had one question. So how much is still left on the table? How much short did we come on the auction?
Madam Chair, we had $1.5 million, so roughly $1 million.
Roughly what?
$1 million. It was still available for sale, but that is we sell $1.5 million each year of the biennium. So next year we'll bring another $1.5 million to the table, and we'll also bring in film and television, and they'll bring their $6 million, and we'll auction that off.
Okay. So basically, will you have $2.5 million for this program then?
No, Madam Chair.
It doesn't accumulate?
No, Madam Chair, members. The legislation allowed the agencies to auction up to $1.5 million for the year $3 million for the biennium. And so we, in this first round of auctions, we opened it up and made available $1.5 million in tax credit certificates. I might add, if I can at this point, I think I'd be remiss if I didn't indicate that at the around roughly $464,000 that we did auction and raise for renewable energy projects in Oregon, it's not a whole lot of money, if you will, because the we are allowed to issue up to $250,000 in one for one project grant. So if we were to dole these out in terms of grants, that's two at the maximum, pretty much, if we're lucky.
Okay. Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. And just a follow-up. Does the statute authorize you to have more auctions before the end of the fiscal year? And if so, do you plan to?
Madam Chair, Representative Barnhart, the law does not restrict how many auctions we offer up. So we could, and we will probably be having further discussions about the timing for
if I could, it does occur to me, tax returns are due on, or at least the taxes to be paid are due on April 15th. Setting an auction soon, that would deal with that that time value of money issue that I was talking about a few minutes ago, might not be inappropriate, especially if we could count on the CPA community to let their clients know that this bargain is available.
Chair Burdick, Chair Barnhart, if I may, and probably Representative Ehrberger could also answer this, but if we did another auction in March, for example, the payment that they make, it would be apply to their 2012 return, so they wouldn't take the credit until they file that return in 2013.
Thank you. I appreciate that correction.
Okay. Representative Brewer.
Unless they have some debt due on April 15th or underpaid. So if you sold the 2011 credit in 2012, they still could use it on their 2011 tax against their tax liability. We could do that still, correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Ehrberger, I don't believe that's how it works. So the payment, it would go to the year they paid, so it would be applicable to 2012. Unless I'm not understanding.
Okay, so they buy a credit. They can. What prohibits a taxpayer, if you were to so have another auction, could you sell a 2011 tax credit certificate and auction those off? Could they still be buying 2011 credits, or are these not by year? These are just general tax credits that are only that only apply for the year that they're bought? Because I'm not sure I understand that difference then. I mean, can you sell 2011 credits? Still?
Let Chris take a shot at that.
We've had conversations, and this is on the potential list for February, and the whole issue is whether or not you can sell the credit after the end of the tax year.
So there
are plenty of places in law that you're aware of that where that can happen. Contributions to IRA can happen after the tax year. We're not sure that the statute as written allows that, so it's on the list of potential issues for February, so that if the committee wants to allow the credits to be sold after the end of the tax year, it could be. But that would be the pleasure that it
okay.
Senator Telfer.
Oh, just two little points. The IRS has extended filing, wherever Phil went, to April 17th this year. And if, in fact, somebody did buy a credit in March, it isn't the following year when they file their tax return that they can recognize that savings on their taxes. They could just reduce their estimated tax payments. So they could almost see immediate cash flow savings.
One way or the other, even
right.
If they couldn't
okay.
take it. Yeah. Okay. All right. Other questions? Thank you very much. We will move on to the liquor apportionment revenue.
Oh, and a PowerPoint.
Oh, my.
Gosh.
How do you come the tech?
How do you move liquor and PowerPoints together?
Well,
you can mix liquor with anything, Senator Telfer.
Is this a tasting?
Here first from our chief of vice.
Our vice chief.
So what the hell are we working on?
Oh.
Move means for us.
Oh, right.
yesterday about the senior medical. I talked about senior medical deduction at the order. You have to turn it over to get to the punchline. That's my tax preparer.
All right, well, technologically set up. You ready?
Chair Burdick, I'm ready. Our presenters have not made it yet. I hope they... We asked them for samples. I hope they didn't drink it on the way.
Yeah, this their samples are a lot better than those tax credits.
So I think we're just ahead by a minute or two.
Yeah. So do you want to do your part and talk slowly, or you want to wait? Do you want to take a recess?
I don't have much.
We could do a recess.
Part to do beyond what they would be talking about. They're talking mostly about. We asked them to update you on the revenue trend and the revenue forecast for the. For the OLCC revenues, as you know, OLCC revenues, about 56% goes to the general fund. So it's a big an important part of what the general fund looks at when they are doing their revenue projections. And, of course, lately with the Washington Initiative 1183, We were looking into the possibilities of how is that going to impact or affect our revenue coming in to the state of Oregon. Is that going to be a negative or a positive impact for us? And then how does that change the competitive picture for the OLCC and Oregon in general? And that's what we have a presentation for you today from the Liquor Control Commission. Okay. And
do we know where they are, Paul? Because we can. The next agenda item is sitting here, all ready to go. So we could go out of order. Are we allowed to do that from our agenda? Go that much out of order? Okay. We will recess this item, and we will move on to our next item. Thank you, Mazen. We will move on to our next item, which is centrally assessed property and enterprise zone or invited testimony. Welcome, Dr. Warner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On your agenda, we have scheduled at 10:15 as our last item, which is centrally assessed property and enterprise zones. What we've done is ask Department of Revenue, actually, to go first on this, if we could, to kind of give us some background. As you know, there's been an issue involving enterprise zone property that Facebook has invested in Central Oregon. The issue involves the treatment of centrally assessed property. And so we've asked Department of Revenue, John Phillips again, to come and describe from the department standpoint how that property has been assessed and how that issue has evolved, and give you a little bit of background. Then we've asked the folks from Facebook to come in and talk about some proposed solutions that they have concerning that property. So we also have, as a Senate committee bill, we do have a committee bill that would address this, and we know there's some other bills out there. Representative McLean has a bill as well on the House side that seeks to address this issue.
Okay, and if I can just give a little context with this, we all understand that the whole issue of central assessment is a huge issue, and there are many players, many issues, many constituencies involved, because basically the fundamental problem is our statutes have not kept up with our technology, and the whole issue of central assessment needs review, and we will do that before 2013. Our reason for taking up this very narrow issue of Facebook at this time is there are some key decisions being made that need addressing right away, but in a very narrow way. And so nothing that we do on this issue in the short session will in any way compromise the larger look we intend to take at central assessment. So go ahead, John.
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that was an excellent overview of the situation that faces us today. The law does require that all property be appraised each year. And as you know, most properties are appraised by the county assessor. We call those locally assessed. And some properties by law are appraised by the Department of Revenue. We call those centrally assessed. And this issue deals with the central assessment of those properties. That there is there a distinction, not only who appraises the property, but there's a distinction that makes a big difference for many companies, and that is the types of property that are appraised can be different. And that is what I'm referring to as intangible property. So that is the crux of the problem, I believe. The communication businesses and services for the last 20 or 30 years have been evolving and have been expanding at an incredible pace. Our statutes, as you mentioned, are old. They've been that particular statute's probably been on the books since 1909, and the word communication since 1909 is nothing what anyone expected it might be. This is a serious problem for our state. We consider it that way, and we are really not trying as a Department of Revenue to frustrate economic development in Oregon. Might sound that way. Somebody might have said that. You might have read that. But contrary to that, we are really not trying to do that. We've been trying to partner and the governor's office has stated this, that we are trying to address this administratively. We've worked with the company and the companies. We've met with the governor and the taxpayer, and we're trying to come to a solution that is would administratively address a narrow portion, this narrow portion that Senator Burdick, you just referred to, and that's the sort of the definition or how we get to what is data transmission. If you don't think it's a difficult problem already, then read the Comcast opinion, because you'll find out that very smart lawyers on both sides argued the case, and the judge said neither one of you got it right. So there is a little confusion out there. We want to move this forward. We want to partner with you on that. We do think that this is a great effort now, but we also have a larger problem, and 2013 might be the best time to address the larger problem. To that end, we've been working on scenarios for how you might implement changes in the centrally assessment statutes relative to communication. Now, other areas like rail, transportation, air, gas, electric haven't come up in the same way that communication has come up, and so that's been where we're trying to focus our efforts. And so I just want to offer that and to be available for questions if you have them for me, or expand into other areas if you'd like me to.
Okay. I'd like you at a minimum to obviously, and I know you will, be available for after the Facebook folks give their presentation to maybe answer questions on that. Representative Wand?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So what steps did the Department of Revenue take during the time that Facebook was working with Business Oregon and the state to hammer out the Rural Enterprise Zone Agreement? What steps did the Department of Revenue take to alert the participants that central assessment was a possibility?
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, Representative Wand, often those discussions occur under a project name that's not known to most people, Project Hazelwood or Project, I mean, there's a name given to it. It's done with certain levels of secrecy for the benefit of the taxpayer. The Economic Development Department and others and counties discuss and negotiate these agreements, and we are typically unaware of them. I don't recall ever saying we don't want to participate. I don't recall ever that kind of thing going on. I don't ever recall being invited to participate. We might not even know they're occurring. The you know, we would be happy to opine or give direction. In fact, in one of these cases that you'll hear about later on, we said, why don't you ask, why don't you, company, ask for a declaratory ruling, and we'll tell you how we think you can be taxed. We also don't think that we've really been hiding a lot of information. A certain company in Wasco County has been assessed centrally since 2009, which predated some of the discussions of the taxpayers now. And that company, the company in Prineville, and the company in Hillsboro have all not seen tax bills reflecting taxation on this level that we're talking about here. In other words, those situations would be consistent with the way we were drafting our rule and the legal opinion that we got in December that's been circulated. But we are, you know, we are struggling. What we've got is a very broad term, and what is communication? You see a communication company, you know, how would you see that? So not all answers, we don't have all answers, because every company has its own unique setup, its design, its property, its services are different.
Quick follow-up.
Briefly.
Thank you. So I understand that these can be secret and that there's a project name. Are you telling us that you didn't know that this was going on and so you didn't have the opportunity to opine before the Rural Enterprise Zone agreement was entered into?
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, and Representative Wand, we may have seen in the paper that there was discussions. I don't know at what point. We wouldn't necessarily know what property was in those buildings. No, I don't think we would have. I don't think we would have been involved in that point.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you. We will move on to the Facebook folks, but Representative McLean is here. Did you want to come up now, or would you rather wait till after the Facebook folks talk?
Now is fine.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. There's a lot that's...
give your name for the record.
Thank you. I apologize. My name is Mike McLean. I'm a state representative for House District 55. My area includes Crook County and Prineville, specifically where Facebook has a data storage center, and there are several data storage centers that have looked at locating in Prineville. Just briefly, Madam Chair, first, I'd love to, thank you for helping. This has been a challenge trying to navigate the repercussions of the Department of Revenue's actions to centrally assess data storage centers in Enterprise Zone. And while they have withdrawn their declared intent, it has created an atmosphere of uncertainty. And the bill that is before the Senate committee and the bill that will be before the House committee that I've submitted will go a long way to putting this to bed and to create an atmosphere where these businesses, before they invest several hundred million dollars and bring in 50-some employees per data center, they'll know what deal that they're going to get. I don't think we could get this done if it wasn't for Chair Burdick's leadership and navigating some folks that were inhospitable initially, but thankfully we've all sort of come to a point which is great, and that is to make sure that people know that when they locate in an enterprise zone, that the deal that they strike with local officials is going to be the deal that they get. And that's really the rub of this, is that we want to honor what our county officials negotiate. We want to maintain the integrity of enterprise zones. And specifically, I can assure you that these data centers matter. And Crook County, which does have the highest unemployment in our state, The amount of construction jobs has been high. The amount of investment is high. These are great jobs. They pay great. And they have, Facebook has been a tremendous citizen. But again, this is an effort that I know Chair Burdick has done a lot on, and I thank you specifically for that. And I'm available to answer any questions.
Okay. Do we have questions for Representative McLean? Thank you very much.
Thank you, ma'am.
Okay. Now, Mr. Manicki and Corey.
Madam Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, Madam Co-Chair, thank you all and the members of the committee for addressing this very important issue and taking the time to talk today. I'd, of course, like to thank Representative McLean also for being here for today and taking a leadership from the perspective of a Prineville company. We're obviously very grateful, and I'd like to echo his thanks to you, Chair Burdick, for your leadership on this issue as well. Mr. Phillips did, I think, an excellent job.
Okay, your name?
I'm sorry. My name is Corey Owens, and I manage state and local public policy and regulatory affairs for Facebook. I am joined here, of course, by Robert Manicki, a partner at Stoll Reeves, who is here to answer the questions that I'm not capable of answering. So I appreciate him being here as well. So Mr. Phillips did tee up this issue very well, and so I won't rehash a lot of what's been said already about central assessment and its history in Oregon. I'd instead like to focus on Facebook's experience specifically and the experience of the data center industry in Oregon. This issue is incredibly important to Facebook because central assessment and an unanticipated central assessment of our properties in an enterprise zone creates a great deal of uncertainty. And as Chair Burdick noted early on, we have a variety of business decisions that have to be made before the 2013 session. The scale of the potential impact of central assessment greatly exceeds on an annual basis the value of the enterprise zone agreement in the first place. That level of uncertainty is significant enough that we have to evaluate very carefully what our investment plans are in Oregon moving forward. Beyond Facebook specifically, and I know that this bill has received the shorthand of the Facebook bill, I'd like to emphasize that the letter that you have before you is co-signed by a variety of other data center operators, and beyond those that are listed there, there are a number of operators who are either in the process of purchasing land or who are considering siting in Oregon right now, and they share our concerns with this issue. This is, while Facebook may be in some ways the poster child of the challenge the companies face when centrally assessed in an enterprise zone, this is about the future of the data center industry in Oregon. And I think, finally, the reason why that should be most important to this committee is the economic impact that data centers represent for not just the community in Prineville, but for the state of Oregon. While data centers are not as labor-intensive as some other developments that might be considered in an enterprise zone, the level of the spend is significant enough that the downstream economic impact is overwhelming. We recently asked the team of economists at Echo Northwest to assess the impact of our facility. And in the first phase of construction alone, they found that our project generated more than 1,000 construction jobs. They also found that on an ongoing annual basis, our project generates 187 jobs in Oregon. And approximately 80% of that impact goes to the state of Oregon outside of the Tri-County area. All of which is to say that the data center industry represents a great deal of potential for the state of Oregon at a time where the state has a great interest in diversifying the kind of industries and the kind of jobs that are here. I will very quickly, and I'll try to be short, describe our experience here in Oregon. In 2008, and I would note prior to the first central assessment of a data center in Oregon, in 2008, Facebook began examining a list of approximately 20 states where we would build our first data center as a company. We narrowed down from 20 states to Oregon as our final estate. Oregon is attractive for data centers for a variety of reasons, ranging from climactic factors to a talented local workforce. But I will say this, the single factor that was most influential in our decision to come to Oregon was the Oregon Enterprise Zone Program. The Oregon Enterprise Zone Program makes Oregon competitive with Washington and Idaho and other states in the Pacific Northwest in a way that without it, we would, I can say definitively, not have come to Oregon. Our experience in Prineville and in Oregon has been, on the whole, I think a resounding success. Our data center in Prineville, the first phase is up and running. We've broken ground on a second phase. That facility now handles a significant percentage of global Facebook traffic. Those of you on the committee who are members, I assure you that your profiles and pages are stored in the high desert in central Oregon, and we're very excited about that. In early 2011, we received notice from the Department of Revenue that they intended to centrally assess us as a communications utility. While we, as you might imagine, disagree with the interpretation of Facebook as a communications company, Mr. Phillips rightly noted that there is a long history of discussion around central assessment and something that we are eager to join others in talking about in the larger 2013 session. I think there seems to be a broad range of support on both sides of the aisle and from industry to reexamine Oregon's position on central assessment. However, in the very short term, there is a problem generated by the central assessment in that it undermines the integrity of the enterprise zones. Enterprise zones in Oregon, whether long-term rural enterprise zones like the ones that we use in central Oregon, or the shorter terms one in the Portland area and other parts of Oregon, provide long-term business certainty for projects like Facebook. Our projects scale at hundreds of millions of dollars per phase. We would like to build multiple phases in Oregon. At that level of investment, we need certainty with regard to what the tax treatment will be with regard to property tax. We reached that agreement in discussions with Crook County, Oregon, Prineville, Oregon, and Business Oregon helped facilitate those discussions from very early on. The central assessment issue has been clouded somewhat by the fact that central assessment of data centers have not thus far included intangible assets. I would like to note that Facebook imagines that our intangible assets could represent a significant portion of the value of our company long term, and as a result, the potential impact of central assessment could easily overwhelm on an annual basis the value of the enterprise zone agreement itself to the level of multiples. The increased liability by central assessment would essentially completely negate the value of the enterprise zone program in Oregon. For that reason, we think that something needs to be done very quickly in order to ensure, one, that projects like Facebook can continue apace, but beyond that, to ensure that Oregon and Business Oregon and the economic development officers in the state can continue attracting the highly paid, highly skilled jobs that data centers represent. Mr. Phillips and his colleagues at the Department of Revenue and the Department of Justice have been exceptional to work with, and they have examined a number of possible administrative solutions, and we're grateful for their assistance in that regard. I will say this, from Facebook's perspective and the companies and entities and government organizations on the letter before you, we believe that this is a statutory problem in need of a statutory solution. I believe that this is best illustrated by the fact that the Department of Revenue felt early on that enterprise zones did exempt intangible assets, and that it wasn't until an intervention from the Department of Justice that it became clear that that might not be true. As Mr. Phillips put very clearly, some of the best tax lawyers in the state of Oregon have very different interpretations of what exactly central assessment and enterprise zone means. And while I'm encouraged by the progress made on the administrative level to invest at the scale that projects like Facebook invest, we need the certainty that comes with a statutory solution. And so I'll stop now and look forward to answering any questions we can. But again, we're very grateful for Chair Burdick and Representative McLean and a number of you on the committee for taking a personal interest. And I can speak definitively on behalf of Facebook. We're very grateful. At no point have we felt anything other than a great desire from members of this committee and the legislature to address this problem quickly and in a way that can encourage development in the future. So thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Does this mean that we can be Facebook friends?
I would like that very much, Chair.
Okay. Robert, do you want to add anything or do you want to be here as a resource?
I'm here as a resource, Chair. Thank you.
Why don't you put your name on the record and then we'll...
My name is Robert Manicky at Stoll Reeves.
Thank you. Okay, questions. Representative Reed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've three questions. First is to ask for some help in understanding the timing of the way the bill works. And I've read through LC that I think is likely to become Representative McLean's bill. So I'm trying to understand the sequence. As I understand it, this is all dependent on being in an enterprise zone. And I'm a little unclear in reading through how it works when an enterprise zone ceases to exist. how the prohibition on central assessment would continue to operate or wouldn't. So could one of you help me with that, please?
Absolutely. So, Madam Chair, Representative Reed, thank you for the question. It's an important one. So the LC-22 draft that's being referred to includes a provision that would extend the exemption from central assessment to data centers and enterprise zones so long as they continue to meet the obligations of their original enterprise zone. So, for example, in year five in a 15-year enterprise zone, should Facebook fail to meet the obligations it's committed to in terms of job generation and average wages, we would, at that point, fail to receive the exemption from central assessment. In the same way, in year 16, when the enterprise zone itself expires, when the enterprise zone agreement itself expires, we would, if we continue to generate the number of jobs that we had been obligated to in year one, we would continue to receive the exemption from central assessment alone. We would, however, pay full freight on the property taxes on the land, on the building, and the equipment in the building. The reason this provision emerged from conversations with Representative McLean and others is twofold. The first, as I mentioned, the potential impact of central assessment. In our conservative estimate, the impact of central assessment could significantly exceed the value of the enterprise zone. So, for example, in years 1 through 15, if the value of the enterprise zone is X, we believe that the impact of central assessment in years 16 through 20 could potentially exceed the value of X in the first place. So at that point, in terms of business certainty, in order to make the kind of investments in durable equipment, so our capital investment is in a building and equipment that we anticipate will far outlast the enterprise zone itself. In order to have the business certainty we need for the exemption from central assessment to continue. The other reason is that we believe this provision actually gives an additional carrot and stick to the local government, cities and counties. So specifically, in year 16, absent this exemption in perpetuity, so long as you're meeting the enterprise zone agreement, companies like Facebook have no significant incentive to continue generating jobs at above median wages in the community. If, however, this exemption is included in Oregon law, at that point, Crook County has a significant carrot and stick in terms of ensuring that companies like Facebook don't, at year 15, stop generating the highly paid, highly skilled jobs that we had committed to in year one. And so I think both from a project development perspective and also from a local government perspective, that provision is very important and potentially very beneficial to the state.
Follow up,
please.
Thank you. The second question was about how, and this may be more of an indication of, or a question about the general way that central assessment works, but if you, so we know about the facility in Prineville, but in other circumstances where you might have additional facilities elsewhere, could you describe how that's going to work, where the provision, what triggers the use of central assessment, and whether that might play into your future plans?
Madam Chair, Representative Reed, the LC-22 draft specifically requires that an operator, their primary asset in the state, be a data center. This was, to the point that Chair Burdick made early on, in recognition of the fact that central assessment is a much larger issue that we hope to be at the table to discuss in 2013, but in the short term to ensure that essentially that somebody couldn't put a computer in a closet, call it a data center, and claim an exemption. So the trigger there is that if your primary asset is in an enterprise data center in an enterprise zone. Existing central assessment law and the Department of Revenue rules already account for the factor, already include factors by which you determine primary use or ownership. Our law, the legislation in front of you would in no way change the way in which central assessment or the Department of Revenue interpret what is primary ownership or primary use. So that's untouched in this legislation.
One last follow-up, Madam Chair. Thank you. The last question, I heard in your opening statements, I think, a lot about why you believe this is essential to happen now as opposed to 2013 or in an administrative fix. But I wonder if I could clarify that. I heard you right. I heard you say you're receiving different interpretations from different well-qualified attorneys and legal professionals and so on. Am I hearing you right that in part, this is very much the role of the legislature to say what we mean the law to be and clarify that intention? Maybe you could say some more about that.
Sure. And Madam Chair, Representative Reed, I think that from our perspective, a number of entities have weighed in on the matter of central assessment of data centers and enterprise zones. That includes Business Oregon, the Department of Revenue, the Department of Justice. I believe the governor has spoken on this matter, the economic development officers in the state, a number of entities. Notably, the one entity that has not yet had the opportunity to weigh in on this matter is the entity that sets tax and economic development policy policy for the state of Oregon. I am, of course, referring to the Oregon legislature. All of those other entities are simply attempting to interpret, as they are best able, the laws that are created by this body. We firmly believe that in order to have the certainty that we need to continue investing at such a large scale, the legislature itself needs to take this opportunity to clarify with some certainty exactly what the interplay of the Enterprise Zone statute is with the Central Assessment Statute.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Wand.
Thank you. So are you aware of any reaction in the industry to the circumstance of the central assessment from the Department of Revenue, and if so, can you, tell us what your experience has been?
Madam Chair, Representative Wand, we after receiving notice of the intent to centrally assess Facebook's data center property, received a number of phone calls in the first week. The first was from the economic development officers who helped negotiate the deal, saying, we don't know what's happened, we're looking into it, bear with us. The second through 10 calls were our peer companies. As you can imagine, this is a fairly small world of operators who operate at data centers at this scale. A number of them are publicly revealed and are on the letter before you. A number of them are not and are considering properties ranging from next door in Prineville to Hillsborough to other parts of the state. Their reactions ranged from simple concern and an interest in finding a resolution to projects that actually said they needed to, that they await resolution of the issue before they feel like they can proceed with larger investments. So I am excited to have the support of our larger industry, and I believe you have before you not only the letter from the data center operators, but also Ray Ramsey from TechNet, who obviously his organization represents the internet industry at large and the data center infrastructure that's needed to support it.
Thank you. Representative Berger.
Thank you. Madam Chair, a couple of things I'd like to kind of explore while you're before me. When was Facebook founded?
Madam Chair, Madam Co-Chair, we were founded in a Harvard dorm room in 2003 by Mark.
I saw the movie.
Did you like it?
Just wanted to nail down the, very snappy dialogue.
Yes.
Just wanted to nail down that date because I kind of feel at some level that we are right now engaged in some sort of a prenuptial agreement with a very young entity, if you don't mind. And you represent, as you just said, a growing segment of sort of the corporate structure. And I get it that you like us and we like you, but is this a long-term relationship is, I guess, the question that I'm trying to get at. You talk about phases as if you have endless experience with phasing in huge data centers, and the truth of the matter is we don't and you don't. So what can you tell me about, you talk about enterprise zones in terms of 16 years. Well, 2003 wasn't very long ago in my life. So I just want on the record some assurance that as we go forward in this relationship, that, somebody else isn't going to just woo you away because, they came along with a better prenup.
Madam Chair, Madam Co-Chair, the point is well taken. So we are a relatively young company, and our industry in its current form is relatively young as well. I will say this. First, the data center that we are building in Prineville represents the single largest expenditure that Facebook has undertaken in its short history. That is to say that unlike some other economic development projects, it would be very difficult to pick up and move our facility and the jobs there to insert state or country. It would be very difficult. So just from a purely practical perspective, we plan to be here for a very long time. From kind of a larger strategic perspective, Oregon is now competing in a global market. The fiber optic technology that is emerging today makes it less important that data center facilities be proximate to the user base that they serve. We selected Oregon from a list of 20 states and a number of provinces in other countries. The other data center operators in Oregon went through the exact same selection process. Oregon is, I can say definitively, one of, if not the most attractive places to build a data center and operate it for the long term. That is true with the notable exception of central assessment of data centers and enterprise zones. So while I can't make I can't sign our prenuptial agreement here at the witness stand today, what I can say is that our our facility in Prineville was the first building we ever owned as a company. It is our flagship property. It is the property from which not only Facebook models all of their data centers, since we open sourced our technology, it is now the model that data center operators around the world are using. Oregon was proof of concept. Oregon proved that it can work, and it proved that you can do it here.
Thank you. One other point. I don't know what a data center is except a series of machines. I know that this machine I have been using for less than 2 years, and I'm now told I need a better machine. So I presume the same is true for your servers. You don't set out a bunch of servers and those are good forever. The technology is rapidly changing. And so my questioning is out of respect for, I want a long-term relationship.
Sure.
Okay, I just want to make sure you want a long-term relationship and your friends in the industry, so that we can walk down this together, because this is a small piece, the sort of Facebook enterprise zone, but mm-hmm. we've already brought forward the bigger piece, which is how our tax structure accommodates something that's never been seen before in terms of these kinds of companies. So thank you for your indulgence.
You know, to your point, I think maybe it'd be helpful if you or Mr. Manicki went into the requirements of the enterprise zone. In other words, the fine print of the prenup, if you will. And because I think that's a very legitimate question or comment that you made. And just, you know, what happens if you do move, what happens if you do not live up to it, what are the consequences?
Sure. And I'll attempt to answer, Madam Chair, in the short, and Robert can step in if I miss anything. Our long-term enterprise zone agreement with Crook County involves a number of commitments on both sides of the coin. Crook County agrees to abate our property taxes for 15 years, specifically the taxes on the building and the equipment inside the building. We continue for that duration to pay property tax on the dirt and on any vehicles on the property. In exchange, Facebook commits to do a number of things, the most significant of which are we agreed to create, I believe, 35 jobs at that facility. We have exceeded that number very quickly. We agree to create jobs at, I believe, 150% of the median county wage. We've also exceeded that. The average annual compensation at that facility is $59,000 per year. As you can imagine, that is a competitive wage in Portland. In Central Oregon, that is a family wage. And we're very excited to have the high caliber employees that kind of compensation attracts. We also agreed to pay a cash payment to the county, I believe, of $110,000 per year. And that payment goes to, we also provide a number of payments to support infrastructure that we make use of, including roads, sewers, and the like. Should at any point in the 15-year agreement we fail to meet those obligations, then our abatement, my understanding, and Robert can correct me, my understanding is we would no longer receive the abatement.
Robert,
if I may, Chair, co-chairs, members of the committee, I would just add to that that this is a prenup with carrots and sticks. The carrots you've heard about, the stick is that if the enterprise zone agreement is violated, there are substantial consequences, including recapture of taxes, there's also the usual look-back ability of the Department of Revenue for 5 years. So it's a legally binding agreement with teeth.
I'd like, if I may, Madam Chair, to just make to extend one of Robert's points about the Department of Revenue's ability to go back 5 years, just to emphasize the kind of seriousness of this issue to us. Mr. Phillips rightly pointed out that they have not assessed any intangible assets of Facebook in this tax year, and we are, of course, appreciative of that. One of our big concerns is the Department of Revenue has statutory authority to go back 5 years and assess assets they missed the first time around. So the business certainty is not just year to year. The central assessment does not just call into question what will our tax bill be next year. It calls into question, might we get hit with a substantial tax bill on intangible assets going back as far as 5 years at any given point in the calendar? That uncertainty, we believe, can be allayed by by an appropriate prenup, a prenup with the county and the city that is respected by the state.
I think you've added to the lexicon, Representative Berger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In light of our prenup, I feel our
Oregon's Facebook status should now be engaged. We're engaged. I don't know. Okay, I do have something technical. Before that, a personal plea. Can Facebook stop screwing around with our settings and ordering? Can you please slow it down? All right, now, one of the things on the Facebook bill, the data center and enterprise zone tie-in and the specificity of this, is looking for relief for, there's a pain going on, and there's a commitment made, and we're trying to solve that, and so it's a relief for a very narrow carve-out. I'm glad to hear that we're going to be able to approach central assessment in a broader way, because this bill is solving a pain, but it doesn't require us at this point in time to clarify the definition of communications or data transmission. And we need to keep our eye on that bigger ball, because the law is quite antiquated, as you said. And we have these young upstarts, these young whippersnapper companies, which we're blessed to have a growing industry focus on Oregon, and that's consistent with who we are as a state and our history, particularly in Washington County and the Silicon Forest. But, we just need to make sure that we holistically look at central assessment, and this doesn't give us a license to avoid those bigger conversations.
Correct.
And Madam Chair and Representative Arbour, I would just note that as has been noted by others, there are a number of other companies and communities that are very interested in that issue. We continue to be interested in that issue as well. Exactly what our business model looks like and exactly what the scale of our business in Oregon looks like long term is obviously something still to be determined. And so we share their interest in 2013 when there is more time to examine the larger issue.
Thank you. Representative Gantz.
Madam Chair, I guess that this, I'm not sure about the value of this question, but I'm curious. You guys are a multi-gazillion dollar company, and you are investing hundreds of millions of dollars in this state. And this seems, it's surprising to me that we find ourselves having this conversation looking back, and I don't like it. I don't like it because I feel like we're being forced to put in a fix that should have been addressed well before you had already built the facility. And not looking at this so much as to figure out who to blame, but it is awkward because if we want to do something, of course, because now you're there, and that's not the way to be making good judgment. This should have happened well before today. So not that I want to have to blame somebody, but I don't want this to happen again, so maybe it'd be worthwhile for you to express to us why you think we find ourselves where we are.
Madam Chair, Representative Benz, I think it is a question of great value. I think that this is not, in our experience, a case of malice or malfeasance by any departments in the Oregon State Government or anything of the sort. I think, as the point that I think Chair Burdick made early on, and I believe Mr. Warner made, the statute in question is more than 100 years old. The Enterprise Zone statute is significant. It is a whippersnapper law, as it were. And I think there is simply a case where it was very difficult to imagine 100 years ago, let alone, 25 years ago when the Enterprise Zone statute was enacted, exactly what this would look like today. And so I'm reluctant to point to any particular fault. Rather, I think it was the best of intentions by a variety of agencies and the legislature itself that we have now finally arrived at the sharp end of the stick where something has to be done to recalibrate those statutes. And I think there's an important opportunity to do that here.
Okay, well, that's didn't quite get to the point. The question is, why wasn't this identified before you spent? How many hundreds of millions have now been spent? Why wasn't it identified?
Identified by Facebook?
Yes, sorry, exactly. You guys have made a commitment. You built the building. You're here. I don't like being put in this position of having to look back. It's a much more interesting conversation before you arrive. Your bargaining power is much greater, but now it's awkward. So I'm just trying to get at why we find ourselves here when you... Because it suggests that the analysis that we're now hearing may not be as good as it should be. or unless you can point out to me why you were justified in not catching this problem earlier.
As, Madam Chair, Representatives, thanks. I think I understand the question now. Prior to Facebook's arrival in Oregon, data centers had not been centrally assessed, period, I believe, and certainly not in an enterprise zone. We were certainly aware of central assessment in Oregon. For instance, we knew that Comcast was being centrally assessed. While I'm not here to pass any judgment on whether or not Comcast should be, we think of cable companies much more like a communications company than we are. It was after we had arrived that this problem first reared its head, and after we had broken ground, all of which is to say that that we felt fairly confident in our analysis of the enterprise zone statute, and we continue to feel fairly confident in the value of the enterprise zone, and the interpretive challenge emerged after we had arrived.
One last follow-up. Please. Thank you. So if we don't, are you sufficiently confident in your interpretation of the enterprise zone statute to take it to court and say we don't think we think we have protection under it from central assessment?
And I'll let Robert speak to this. So we are engaged. We began to engage in litigation regarding central assessment of our facility. That case was held in abeyance before it was ever argued before the Oregon Tax Codes Court. So that is to say, yes, we feel confident enough in our interpretation of the enterprise of the central assessment statute to take it to court. We are optimistic that this can be resolved without it coming to that and without interfering with the Comcast case, which has, of course, already been argued and is ongoing at the Oregon Supreme Court level.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I just want to get a couple of clarifications and one question out there. It occurred to me as you were talking, and it had not occurred to me earlier, that there are actually multiple kinds of enterprise zones. The Prineville Enterprise Zone is a long-term rural EZ. Is that correct?
Yes.
And my understanding of Section 3, subsection 3A of the LC-22 is that this applies to both long-term rural EZs as well as regular enterprise zones that an urban area might designate. Is that correct?
And Madam Chair, Representative Bailey, the short answer is yes. It was definitely the goal in our conversations with Representative McLean and Chair Burdick to ensure that this was not something that would just provide business certainty for the data centers that are looking in central Oregon, but also the data centers that are looking to build in the urban areas that have different flavors of enterprise zone.
Paul.
Please, Paul.
But the sections that are here do not apply to enterprise zones in the reservation enterprise zone program. And is that because the central assessment issue is not relevant to that, to those enterprise zones?
I'll defer to Robert on that one.
Madam Chair, Representative Bailey, there was no intention to exclude particularly the enterprise reservation zones or other flavors of enterprise zones. Rather, what we were focusing on was those kinds of enterprise zones that give rise to an agreement with the local government so that the terms of those agreement could continue to be honored by the company after the enterprise zone exemption has ceased and continue to give rise to the exclusion from central assessment.
Early on in our discussions with local communities like Crook County and the city of Prineville, it became very clear that it was important to local governments that any discussion of enterprise zones in the context of central assessment acknowledge essentially their bargaining power at the table, their ability to require companies to do certain things. Some of the flavors of enterprise zone require that kind of written agreement between a local government and a business. Others do not. So just to add that context.
Comment. Please.
This is perhaps for staff. I'd be curious. I'm just not familiar enough with the intersection between central assessment and reservation land. I'd just be curious to know a little bit more about that and to get some clarification on why certain areas and not other areas. But I am happy to know that this is a tool that's available for urban areas as well as rural areas. Thanks.
Okay. Other questions? All right. Thank you very much. We will continue the conversation.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. We're a little behind schedule. We now have our liquor apportionment revenue presentation from the OLCC. I assume they're all here.
Jenny, we had a question for Phillips.
I'll catch him afterwards.
You sure?
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll do it later.
Madam Chairs, co-chairs, committee members.
No.
For the record, I'm Steve Farrow, Director of the Liquor Commission. Happy to be here today. And I'd also like to go ahead and introduce our new chair.
Good morning, Madam Chair, co-chairs, co-vice chairs. My name is Cassandra Skinner-Lapata. I'm the new chair of the OLCC.
Welcome aboard. Could be a bumpy ride.
It already has.
So, I'm sorry, I'm not familiar with how to start this. Do I just hit the button?
Technical issues.
No, I apologize. I know on my screen how to do it. Thank you.
You go.
Yep, okay. We're ready to go.
Okay, and if we could move through this quickly and allow maximum time for questions, that'd be great.
Okay. We'll just move through it pretty quickly then. We're going to bring good news because revenues are up and we are forecasting greater growth. Let's go on to the next slide. One of the, I think the strong points that we're seeing within the economy from our standpoint is the growth of local distilleries. There are now over 40 local distilleries within the state, and that's not only beneficial in terms of the local industry that is generated by that, but the sustainability and the fact that these local distilleries also buy local, and it has also increased sales. Currently, we're looking at around 336 Oregon products that we currently carry in the market. That's a good thing. And I just want to go ahead and point out the statement that we have from the Oregon Distillers Guild up there. And I really want to emphasize that the commission has worked very closely with the local distillers to try and create opportunities for them within the marketplace, and that is a very big part of what we do, and we're happy to see that growth. Hmm. You can see from the map they're spread all over the state. Let's talk for a moment about retail liquor stores. We currently have 246 independently owned, that's privately operated liquor stores within the state. For 2009-11, we generated $869 in gross revenues. And I want to point out that those small businesses that we have throughout the state, they put money back into the local economy. The revenues that come to the commission itself, the profits, that goes down here to Salem. So all that money is staying within the state. You can see from the revenue source of what we do generate, it's quite clearly over 95% is distilled spirits. Privilege tax, which is the beer and wine tax, is a mere 3.6%. Net income for the previous biennium, you can see it there. General fund got to almost $200 million. Point out that cities and counties also had a pretty nice amount of cash going to them. The good news, current revenue projections for the biennium, when we went through the budget process, we were looking at $920 million in gross sales. We have now upped that to almost $960 million in gross sales. The trend when we started the biennium was around 3%. We, in December, broke 5% in terms of growth. and it appears that we're going to be continuing to pick up speed, which is a good thing from a revenue standpoint. So with the current projection, we're now looking at contributing $15 million net more to the state than what we originally looked at for the start of the biennium. You can see from the chart that during the really tough times of the recession for the commission, it was relatively flat. But the market has come back, and decidedly so. There seems to be a preponderance of buying up in the marketplace, and that includes the very upper end, which means the growth is going to really proceed quickly. Gross annual liquor forecast, you can see that by the chart, it's still looking very good. General fund is also going to benefit from that process. And for next biennium, in the 13-15 biennium, we're actually looking at, for the biennium itself, breaking $1 billion in sales, and that's pretty significant for us. Part of the revenue generation is a 50-cent surcharge. That's the background for it. For this biennium, we're looking at around $29 to $30 million generated by the surcharge alone. Certainly, there's been a lot of controversy and comment about the initiative in Washington, 1183. Well, that initiative in Washington, 1183, essentially made Washington the most deregulated state in the country, and it's pretty significant. I want to go over some points with regards to 1183. If there are any questions, please feel free to interrupt at any time. First off, one of the generators with regards to Washington, they had about 1,000 employees involved in their retail and distribution arm with regards to the liquor board up there. We have a total of 67 state employees. Significant difference. 67 for Oregon, around 1,000 for Washington. Once again, our stores are privately owned, and those are individuals that are out there that are agents for us, and they actually invest all their money, take all the risk, and help benefit the state considerably. You can also see from Washington, by having so many of its own state stores, there were significant leasing costs with regards to that program. Next one. Currently, when we project Washington prices, Oregon prices are about 5% less than Washington prices at this point. There's some question about where Washington prices will actually go. I will cover that a little bit later, but it looks like they're going to be going up. You might refer in the next chart, there's always been comment about prices in control states like Oregon that are significantly higher than private. Well, we did a comparison back in 2010 just to take a snapshot against California and Washington. You can see by the list there that Oregon actually did very, very well. In fact, we were lowest overall. So when you take a look at that and compare it against where prices probably will go in Washington, we expect to still do very well with regards to the competition. There will certainly be some deep discounters that will come into Washington. That isn't what we do. There will certainly be some that engage in loss leaders. Those of you that are familiar with loss leaders with regards to the retail market, they'll engage in loss leaders to get you through the door. The state, Oregon, does not engage in that. So there will be some challenges there in terms of how their prices will go. But overall, we still think we'll be very comparable or better. The impacts of 1183 to Oregon. Okay, so price is always a big thing for all customers. We all feel that. There was a model that was produced by the Washington Office of Financial Management that basically took a price of a current Washington bottle at $15.95. It projected the likely low price, and it ended up at $15.49, and the high price about $17.90. So if you take their projections, we will still be very comparable or still less if you can go ahead and hold to those projections. And once again, when you get into the marketplace, they can compete at any time, at any level, can change their prices. That is not what Oregon does. So there will be some challenges that we will face, but we think we can do very well against them. Oregon's revenue for the biennium, $869 million. Some question about impact to Oregon itself. And I think really a lot of that comes down to where we think the prices are going to be. If the prices are significantly more in Washington, there will not only be not a negative impact, but actually a positive impact along the Washington-Oregon border for Oregon sales. If the prices are comparable or a little less, then there would probably be some bleed off because the convenience within Washington, the fact that it can be in any big grocery store, will create opportunities for their customers to buy over there and would then be less likely to pick it up in Oregon. With regards to the rollout of 1183, it's March 1st deadline for distributors. That's when distributors can start delivering to the on-premises, that's the bars, taverns, et cetera, and June 1st for customer walk-in sales. So the prices for delivery to the from the distributors to the licensees, will be able to start seeing those prices come March 1st, and we'll be able to see customer prices come around June 1st. So that'll pretty begin to give us a pretty good idea about where we're going. I want to point out the State Line Liquor Store in at Jansen Beach. That agent has done a fabulous job of converting what was really a lackluster store, did his own investment. I want to make it clear that the agents bear the brunt of taking some of these risks. When they go ahead and move to a better location, when they build a better store, when they make a remodel within that store, the state does not fund any of that. That all comes on the backs of the agents, and they're doing a really great job of upgrading. Recently, we've been involved in some retail rules changes. I want to point out that there's been some comment that these rules may have been reactive to 1183. That's not true. In fact, we started talking about these rules or these changes within the system as far back as 2009, and there was actually a task force appointed by then-Chair Phil Lang to look at this. It wasn't just staff that was looking at these rule changes. We actually had private industry in there with us. In fact, there was one or two legislators that were invited. I know at least one time one legislator did, in fact, sit on the committee. So we started looking at these changes a long time ago. I would put these changes that we're proposing as evolutionary, a natural evolutionary move within the marketplace itself. One of the things that we did go ahead and pass the rule with regard to pilot projects, the industry and business out there moves at a much faster rate than the rules process. So we needed to go ahead and change so that we could respond better to the changes that need to meet the needs of our customers out there. For instance, in Cannon Beach, we had one liquor store in Cannon Beach. It was a very nice liquor store, but it was sort of off the main road. Therefore, a lot of the customers that come down in the summer would not see that. We worked with the agent in Cannon Beach to open up a satellite store. That satellite store is located right off the main road. He has already got a lot of business. So what we're saying with these pilot programs, there may be opportunities for us to look at different ways to approach the business model, and we want to be able to be more flexible to meet those needs. That rule has already been passed. The number four rule, which is agent resignation buyout, which actually enhances the resignation buyout that the agent gets from the incoming agent, that also has passed. That's done. The other two rules will be reviewed in March, and that will come up for a vote in March. Those deal with the ability for liquor stores that are exclusive liquor stores to sell Oregon beers and wines, providing that they go ahead and meet our business plan. And the other one is corporations to become eligible as liquor agents. So let me talk about the beer and wine first. So that's actually not something new. We have a number of exclusive stores, non-exclusive stores within the state that sell beer and wine on many occasions. Some of them, we even have a non-exclusive store that sells guns and ammo. So we look to go ahead and meet the needs of the community. So if you went to a small community and tried to have just an exclusive liquor store, then that liquor store would not be able to survive just selling on the distilled spirits, so we allow them to have other products. Non-exclusive are usually in the bigger towns or cities. Those are exclusively held to selling distilled spirits and then some auxiliary items that we have by rule allow. So what we're looking at is now developing another, what I would call a very moderate or evolutionary change to the exclusive stores, that if they present the kind of business plan that shows progressive, that shows the space available, that shows the relocations, the remodeling, whatever may be necessary, they would be able to sell wine and beer also. Now, when we've talked with the agents out there that have shown interest in selling beer and wine, almost exclusively they have talked about selling Oregon wines and Oregon microbreweries. So it would be a big boon to both of those industries also. And it does make for a more, I think, a greater customer convenience. So that's something that we're looking at with the rule change. With regards to corporations, this is just a minor change also. We currently have store within a store in at least two. We did have it in three grocery stores out there. We do have within our non-exclusive stores around the state also have liquor there. So what this does, it allows corporations not to have to have a middleman currently, if you wanted to go ahead and have, for instance, in a Safeway, if you wanted to compete for a liquor store, you have to have, like, your produce manager, your meat manager, somebody like that, actually be the individual that puts in for the store, and then you let them have a store within the store. What we're looking at now actually takes that need for that middleman out, which means the corporations could compete like anybody else for a liquor store. And we're not talking about on the shelf. This is not on the shelf next to the baby food. This is not on the shelf next to the beer and wine. This is an exclusive store within a store. And we currently have two, now that we have the West Bend store now has moved down to the Ray's Market there, a QFC, and also we have one in a Thriftway. Both of those are very successful. So this is just what I would consider a minor adjustment to something we've already been doing. Okay. Here's an example. This is a picture of the store within a store at Bethany up in Portland. And you can see it fits right in. It does very well. And I'm sure if you ask the QFC manager there, he would say it's a real benefit for them. And I think you would find for most of the grocers that if they could go ahead and have options, they would probably explore this and take advantage of this option. This chart really shows what I consider is a great movement forward by the agency and the agents. The agents have been very, very, very aggressive in terms of trying to improve their stores. Once again, it's their money that they spend and invest. You can see by relocating or remodeling, these are just some of the examples that take place. Great growth in terms of 53%, 20%, 21%. When you move the store to a greater or to a nicer location or what we would consider a more convenient location, it's not that we're trying to entice customers in. We're not doing that. That isn't our objective. But if you have a really great retail experience, customers respond to that. They go to those locations, and in many cases, they buy more and buy up. So that's one of the things we're seeing. This is an example of a relocation remodel. The lower right is what the store did look like. They relocated to another location and did an extensive remodel, and you can see it's a very attractive look. And once again, it was the agent that put the money up for that. So where are we for the next 10 years? We're expecting at this point, with sales accelerating the way they are, to exceed $2.2 billion net to the state over the next 10 years. And you can take a look at the other numbers. So that's it pretty much in a flash. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you. This has been a good presentation, and I appreciate you moving through it quickly. Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Just a brief comment. The initial slide that you put up with the shelf of liquor products, if I'm right, I believe at least 10 of those bottles originated in my district. And so I just wanted to say that we have a great craft distillery industry in the state of Oregon, and I really appreciate the work that the OLCC has done to make sure that craft distilleries are featured prominently in liquor stores, that we have a local industry, and that people are able to select local craft-made products right next to and in competition with the other products. So,
Chair, members of the committee, I don't think we could have planned it any better for that.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to second that. I think one of the great things about Oregon is that we're building local industry in craft beer, local production, and in these distilled spirits, and some of them are wonderful products, and in fact, I would say all of them are wonderful products, and those who are used to using the big national brands ought to try them. The question I had really was on a slightly different topic. I understand, and I'm not an expert on this at all, is that the Washington Initiative actually includes some kind of a tax to replace the profits that they were getting under the old system. Do we have any idea whether that's going to produce the kind of income that they had before, or is this up in the air, or what can you tell us about that?
Chair, co-chairs, vice chairs, committee members, I think that's the big question. We will see coming pretty quickly where the prices will go. The customers will react to those prices and may or may not buy. It is a fairly aggressive pricing structure that Washington or that 1183 essentially put in. I have heard from no less than five industry representatives that the prices are going to be more significant in Washington, which would not bode well. It certainly is not very helpful for the craft distillery industry in Washington, because when I read one of the articles that one of the craft distillers had put out, They then also said that the prices would go up. So there's a series of taxes and fees that are, that make up this, you know, margin that they're looking for. And like I said, the projections show very, very likely not being much less than the current price, but potential being certainly much more than the current price. So the question comes with what is required by the distributors in terms of the profits they have to give to the state in terms of the 27, I think it's 27% between the retailers and distributors. With everything else that you throw in there, including the margins for the retailers, is it going to go up? That's the big question.
Yeah, I'll follow up quickly if I could. Oregon has a very efficient warehousing distribution system for spirits, doesn't it? And that being the case, it's hard for me at least to imagine that a different system involving a bunch of different distributors and a bunch of different retailers for spirits could compete with the system we have now on price.
Co-chair, or Chair Burdick, co-chair Barnhart, we certainly see that from our standpoint in terms of the model with having one distribution center, although I will tell you that we will probably be asking for a smaller distribution center also to be sent put in Southern Oregon due to the expansion. It is highly unlikely that when you take the economies of scales that we have by going through one location and distribute that out through a number of other distributors that you're going to have the efficiencies there. Now, to be sure, some of the distributors that will operate up there have very effective programs and are very efficient in what they do. But the very natural, and in fact, there was a study done for Alberta, Canada. They privatized in 1993, and the study was done in 2010. One of the things that the study showed is that when you differentiate the market that much, meaning have so many locations to go by, it becomes somewhat inefficient in terms of you got to carry so many different inventories out there for so many different locations that you actually had to raise the price because of the carrying costs. So, you know, I think part of the challenge that will be up there is with this diffusion of distribution locations, is it going to work? To be sure, private industry does a great job, but I would say I would invite anyone to come to our location and look at our warehouse and how well we do. We're going to do a great job and continue to do a great job, so it'll be a great challenge for us.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Representative Berger. Real quickly, I appreciate the efficiency of OLCC in distributing liquor and in an efficient and cost-effective manner and maximizing the dollars for the taxpayers. Two things, however, about our system that you have not addressed that bother me a lot, and you may not be able to answer them right now. One is, by the very fact of your existence, you do create an uneven marketplace. And that's what happened, I think, in Washington. Yeah, grocers want one thing, liquor people want something else, and the taxpayers decided what they were going to get. And this has been an ongoing problem. The other thing that bothers me is that we have come to be promoting a product that you're also regulating. And there's a sort of a disconnect in there. We're celebrating what we basically originally started to, the state got involved because it was seen as a sin that we had to strictly regulate. Well, now we're literally promoting this product and regulating at the same time. These things bother me a lot about our system, and I don't think you could address them in a two-minute piece, but they weren't in your remarks, and I think these are things that we're thinking about a lot with regard to the Washington situation.
Madam Chair, I could respond at least to some of that.
Yes, as briefly as possible.
Okay. One of the things I want to stress again, that the commission exists primarily for public safety. I want to go on the record with that. We do have a balancing process that we go through when it comes to the promotion versus the enforcement issues that the commission goes through. And we don't really promote. It may be seen as promotion, and we're proud of the agents and the job we do. But we don't try to entice anybody into liquor stores. If you go into to many of the uncontrolled states, you have what they call loss leaders. So they'll take a product that really moves pretty fast. They'll lower the price way down. They'll advertise it, they'll get you to come through the door, and then they'll get you to buy something else at another price. We don't engage in any of those practices. We do not allow any of our agents to engage in any of those practices. So the promotion portion of it, I would characterize it more as making it, as we say, reasonably available to responsible adults who want to drink. And that's what I would go on the record with.
Thank you. Thank you. Other questions? Thank you very much. We will close this part of the conservation hearing.
And let me just close, if I may, and then it'll be your thing. I simply would note that the House Revenue Committee is going to adjourn now so the Senate Revenue Committee can finish its business. I would want to make certain that both senators and representatives are aware of our meeting tomorrow at 1 o'clock, where we're going to have a public hearing on the issue involving the deferred property tax issue. Senators are invited to attend if you'd like. We'd appreciate that. Other House and Senate members are also invited to attend. We expect there will be a significant number of people to testify at that meeting. And with that, unless there's some other business, the House Committee on Revenue is adjourned.
Thank you. Thank you, House colleagues.
Friday.
Senior property class.
Oh, yeah.
We will open a work session. Sorry.
To make sure that our.
We'll recess.
No, it was burger.
For 2 minutes.
So I can take that, and then I have my senior medical deduction too that I can swing by for
dinner
tomorrow.
Which
assuming I can get here without it. My car got swept last night.
So where are you on this?
And it was dark. And there were people in front of me, and all of a sudden, no, it was up to the middle of my doors, and the car was rocking in the fairway.
And
it completely shorted out the car. Yeah.
Oh, he gets to leave and all of us have...
We didn't catch him in time.
Okay, we will reconvene the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee, and we will open a work session for the possible pre-session committee bill introduction. Dr. Warner, quickly.
Madam Chair, we have four bill LCs for committee introduction. You have your work plan, has the list of that four, and it's on the back of that work plan, and you have copies of the four LCs.
That's wonderful. And we've discussed these at a previous meeting, and that is all on the record. So, Senator Morse, I would love a motion.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that we adopt as committee bills the following bills, LC 91, dated 1-9-12, LC 130, dated 12-23, LC 131, dated 1-3, and LC 162, dated 12-29.
Okay, Senator Morris has moved that we introduce as committee bills LC 91, LC 130, LC 131, and LC 162. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. We are adjourned. Thanks, Chris.
I'll see you later this afternoon.
All right. All right.